Hey, you're tuned in to the Verve Podcast live from the heart of Las Vegas, Nevada. Thanks for listening, and viva la Verve!
What you do is determined by what you think of you. What you do is determined by what you think of you, but that's not why you think you do what you do. You think that you weigh pros and cons. You think that you do what makes you happy. You think you're trying to be a good person. No, what you do is determined by what you think of you. And what you think of you probably isn't true. When I was a kid, in between the weekend cartoons, they used to show these, they were called Saturday Morning Brain Food. They were public service announcements, educational for kids, and they featured an animated character named Timer. Timer looked like an ugly lemon who had come to life with a big pocket watch and a bigger nose. And Timer would sing songs to educate us kids. Some of you may remember these. Like one song he sang was, "I hanker for a hunk of cheese." And the idea of the song was that cheese and cracker sandwiches make for a very nutritious snack for kids. Well, duh. Of course, a chunk of saturated fat on an edible little plate of carbohydrates is a nutritious snack. We didn't need Timer to figure that one out. In another commercial, he taught us kids that you are what you eat. That's who you are. You are what you eat. Just in case you never saw Timer, probably most of you didn't. Some of you are too young to have seen Timer. I wanted you to see how bad these were so you'd understand, those of us who grew up in the 70s, why we are the way we are. So it's the quality's not great. It's from however 40 years ago, but here's Timer.
Hi there, time for Timer, your roving reporter. I'm talking to you from inside a fantastic factory, your digestive system. You know what we build here? You. Not out of wood or metal, but out of food. You see, you are what you eat, from your head down to your feet. Things like meat and eggs and fish you need to build up muscle tissue. Uh-oh. Hello, appetite control, more protein. We need energy. Playing tennis today, you know. Whoops. All these motors in your body need a lot of fuel to go on, like carbohydrates, fats and proteins, vitamins, and so on. What's left over forms the building blocks you need, indeed, to grow on. Yes, you are what you swallow, so that next time you feel hollow, don't just fill your face with any old kind of treat. This goes for every kid or six-foot athlete. All you really are is what you eat.
Now you know why I'm so messed up, and some of the rest of you are too. Just in case you didn't catch the words, the chorus said this: all these motors in your body need a lot of fuel to go on, like carbohydrates, fats, and proteins, vitamins, and so on. What's left over forms the building blocks you need indeed to grow on. I'm pretty sure that the proteins and vitamins and such are the building blocks we need, and what's left over are not building blocks. What's left over is, well, you know, poop. That's what's left over. But what I really take issue with is Timer's assertion that you are what you eat. I realize that what you put in your body is important, but what we are, what you are, is what you think about yourself. It's your self-perceived identity. That may not completely define who you are, but what we believe about ourselves, our self-identity, does dominate why we do what we do, the decisions that we make, how we treat other people, how we do our jobs when we go off to work, how we relate to God, and just about everything else in life. Here's one of the ways the Bible says this truth. Proverbs chapter 23, verse 7, put on the screen. The Bible says, "For as he thinks within himself, so he is." What's that saying? What you do is determined by what you think of you. And listen, you don't have to believe the Bible to believe that, because it's been proven repeatedly. Social scientists study, why do people do what they do? Why do you do what you do? Why do you spend more money to get a better brand of hot dogs, but you buy the cheapest gas? Why, when you go to social functions, do you feel like you have to dress a little bit better than everyone else? Or why do you feel like you have to dress a little bit worse? Why do you vote Democrat or vote Republican? Why? And what they've discovered is that though some decision-making is based on kind of analyzing the costs and benefits, it turns out that far more often we make our choices based on what James March calls the identity model. James March is a professor at Stanford University, and he says that when we make decisions, what happens inside of us is we essentially and subconsciously ask ourselves three questions. Who am I? What kind of situation is this? And what would someone like me do in a situation like this? That's how you make your decisions. And this helps explain why a poor, self-employed shrimper in Alabama would vote against a Democrat who would give him health insurance, and why a Hollywood millionaire would vote against a Republican who would cut her taxes. I mean, if our decisions are made on self-interest, those decisions make no sense at all. But if what we do is based on our self-perceived identity, well, those decisions could make all the sense in the world. What you do is determined by what you think of you. And there has been tons of research demonstrating the enormous power of our self-identity in our decision-making. Here's one example. Two Stanford University psychologists in the 1960s went door to door in a neighborhood in California asking people for permission to put a drive safely billboard into their yard. They showed them a picture of the billboard. It was huge, poorly constructed. The person quickly realized if they said yes, it would take up their entire front yard and completely block the view of their house. 83% of the homeowners said no. My question is, why did the 17% say yes? Kind of weird, but okay. 83% said no. Let me interrupt the story with a quick question. Why do you think they said no? But you think it's because of self-interest, right? I mean, they very quickly weighed the pros and cons of having that billboard in their yard, and they realized that there was not nearly enough benefit to outweigh the costs. Why do you think that? Because you believe that your decisions are based on assessing pros and cons. But as we'll see in the series, that's not true, and it's a big part of your problem and my problem. Back to the story. In a nearby neighborhood, just real close, what they did was these psychologists had a group of people go 2 weeks prior, and they went door to door. They said that they were representing a organization that helps people to drive safely, and they asked if they would be willing to put a small little sign that says, "Be a safe driver," in a window of their house or in their car. It's a little sign. And about half of the people in this neighborhood agreed. Well, 2 weeks later, at the same time they're over in that neighborhood, they came over to this neighborhood, those two Stanford psychologists, and they knocked on the door and they asked the same question. Would you be willing to put this big eyesore billboard that says drive safely, is going to take up your entire front yard, completely block the view of your house, would you be willing to put this in your front yard? And 76% of the people who had agreed to put the little Be a Safe Driver sticker in their car or in a window said yes to putting the massive billboard in their yard, which means 38% of the people in this neighborhood said, yes, I'll put the big ugly billboard in my yard. And it was only 17% in that neighborhood. Why? Why? Well, the researchers concluded that agreeing to put the small little card in their windows shifted the homeowner's sense of identity. That one act led them to become, in their own eyes, the kind of people who do that kind of thing. They now thought of themselves as concerned citizens who were trying to help make sure that people wouldn't encounter or create dangerous situations on the roads. And that newly formed self-identity led them to give a different answer to the request of having the big obnoxious billboard in their front yard. When asked if they would do that, they went through the same series of questions that we all do whenever we're faced with a decision. Subconsciously, they asked, who am I? What kind of situation is this? And what does a person like me do in this kind of situation? Their identity drove their behavior, just like our identity drives our behavior. But we see this all through the Bible because the Bible tells stories of human beings, and this is how human beings work. One example would be Moses. I realize you already heard Moses' story. I don't know that I could tell it any better than you heard it earlier, but just to kind of give you an overview, Moses grew up in Egypt, and he was the adopted son of the Pharaoh. Pharaoh was the king of Egypt. He was pretty much the most powerful man in the entire world. But Moses knew that even though he was growing up the prince of Egypt, he knew that by birth, his birth parents were Hebrews. The Hebrews were the people who Pharaoh held in slavery in Egypt. One day, Moses was out walking through the city, and he saw an Egyptian abusing his Hebrew slave, and in a fit of rage, Moses killed the abuser. He realized that this would put his life in jeopardy, and so he ran. He left the city, and eventually, living as a fugitive, he got a job shepherding sheep. One day, Moses saw this bush on fire, but it wasn't burning up. Big fire, but it wasn't burning up, and so he decided to go over and check it out. I have a personal policy. I walk away from fires, but Moses decided to go to it, and the bush spoke to him. Again, if I hear a bush speak to me, I'm getting away from the bush. Moses stayed. And not being used to hearing plants speak, he asked the bush if the bush would identify himself. And God, speaking to Moses from the bush, said that he was God. Well, Moses grew up in the palace of Pharaoh, where many gods were worshipped. And so he asked God, the bush God, if he would please be more specific. And God told Moses that he was the only true God. And he told Moses his first name. God said, my name is I Am. That's who I am. I am that I am. God told Moses that he had heard the cries of the Hebrew people coming up to him, and he had decided that he was going to set the Hebrew people free. Specifically, he was going to have Moses lead them to freedom. Moses looked God right in the eye. Well, technically, I guess he looked God right in the flaming leaf. And Moses said, no, no way. Why did Moses say no? Same reason we make our decisions. It was based on what he thought of himself. In fact, if you read the story in the conversation, Moses repeatedly says to God, who am I? Why are you asking me? Do you know who I am? Who am I to do something like that? Who am I? See, Moses had gone from thinking of himself as the prince of Egypt, he was, to thinking now he was a murdering fugitive turned sheep herder. Does it make any sense for a murdering fugitive turned sheep herder to represent God and go make demands of a king? No, it doesn't. Why did Moses say no? Because what you do is determined by what you think of you. Why should Moses have immediately said yes? Because he wasn't who he thought he was. He wasn't. Moses had murdered someone. He had run away. He was living as a fugitive. He was herding sheep. But that's not who Moses was. See, Moses' problem was an identity crisis. He had just met God. He was now on a first name basis with God. He now knew God, but he didn't really know himself. In fact, I think if you asked Moses, he would have told you, I know I am, but who am I? I know I am, but who am I? See, Moses was living with a false identity, and it was driving his behavior, just like everyone's identity drives their behavior. Are you realizing yet how important this is? This is completely life-changing for us. This explains why you do what you do and how you can make changes in your life if you choose to. Our attempts at personal transformation typically take the form of behavior modification, right? And so we make decisions and we say things like, I'm going to quit smoking on January 1st, or that's it. I'm never looking at pornography again. Or this year I'm going to eat healthy and exercise every day. Or I am going to stop dating men who are mean to me. In fact, I'm not going to date at all for a while. Or I'm going to read the Bible every day and pray every morning this year. Or I'm not going to exaggerate or lie or gossip to get attention for myself or make myself feel better. I know it's wrong. I'm not doing it anymore. Does it work? Why? It's because we realize we need to change our behavior based on a cost-benefit analysis of our behavior. We realize there's more cost than benefit, and so we make this commitment. Problem is, our everyday decisions are not based on cost-benefit analysis, so we don't keep the commitment we made. Our decisions are based on our identity. And if our identity doesn't change, we will eventually go back to those same behaviors we swore we wouldn't. So it turns out, getting unstuck, changing, finally stopping doing the thing you don't want to do, or finally starting to do the thing you really want to do, won't happen if we try to change the behavior. It will only happen if we change our identity. The problem is an identity crisis. You're not who you think you are. You may have done some things, but those things don't define you. You may know God, but I wonder if you don't really know yourself. Your problem is an identity crisis. You have a false identity. If that's true, if you're buying into this, okay, and I think you should, how? How could a person get a false identity? How would that even happen? Here's how. We like to think that we are self-made, right? Especially like in America, like I've set my own course and I've decided who I am. No. The truth is that our identities are largely based on outside information that we receive about ourselves. But basically, we are an amalgamation, a mixture of the messages that we've received in life about us. But what you believe about yourself is largely based on what you've been told about yourself. We're kind of like sponges. We just soak it all in, and over time, it starts to form our identity, who we think we are. Now, we don't necessarily take in every message. What we do is we tend to receive messages from people who we view as credible sources. Your parents, maybe grandparents, maybe your friends back when you were in school, maybe the bully at school, maybe an influential teacher or coach. Those messages start to seep in. So one of the pioneers of sociology was named Charles Cooley. Charles Cooley developed this idea that he called the looking glass self. It's very accepted in sociology. A looking glass is like an old-timey word for a mirror. And what he said was that what we believe other people think about us becomes the mirror that we see ourselves in. Those messages received from other people, especially people who we view as credible, as authoritative, they start to tattoo you psychologically with indelible ink. Especially the messages that we receive early in life or often in life. And if you receive a message early and often, especially from someone who you think is a credible source, man, it is really hard to remove that tattoo. So first, there's the early information factor. If you receive messages early in life from people who you view as credible, it's a real good chance that they'll start to mold what you think about yourself. You've seen this in other people. You probably don't recognize it in yourself, but I bet you've noticed it in other people. For instance, this is why you can be sitting with a woman who has two PhDs, and she'll tell you that she's not smart. You're like, what? Well, it's because that's what she was told by her parents when she was growing up, and It's how she views herself. Or maybe you've known a salesman who is really bad at what he does, but he has this extreme confidence and he thinks he's great at it. And you're like, why? Well, it's because he had parents who convinced him that he was valuable regardless of his achievements. Or you might know a very successful businessman, very successful, who thinks of himself as a failure. And you're like, it just doesn't make any sense. Well, it's because he vividly remembers hearing that from his father over and over when he was just a young kid. Obviously, the danger here is that these early information that we receive is not necessarily correct information. But if it comes from a reliable, what we think is a reliable source, it can become embedded in our identity if we receive it early. Then there's the often factor. I'm going to do something with you. Some of you have maybe done this with me because I do it in a class here at Verve. If you've done it before, opt out. Okay, don't do this because you'll ruin it. But we're going to say a word together 10 times fast, and then I'm going to ask you a question and just answer the question immediately. Okay, simple. So we're going to say the word yoke 10 times in a row. Yoke. Okay, and then I'm going to ask you a question. You guys ready? If you've done this before with me, don't do this now. Ready? Ready? Here we go. Yoke. Yoke. Do this. Well, you guys are all sitting there. Come on, let's do this. Ready? We ready? We're going to say yoke 10 times. Real easy. Ready? Yoke, 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 yoke. The white of an egg is a? The white of an egg is not a yolk. You all just said yolk. That's not an egg white. It's not a yolk. See, this is marketing 101. Marketing is all based on repetition. Because they know if you receive a message often enough, it starts to burrow its way into your brain. I'm going to do something else. You're not going to be able to participate if you're like younger than 40-ish, but join with me if you're in my age range or older. I want you to start singing along with me when you know the words. Okay, ready? Set. You got to do it. Two all beef patties special. So some of you who are younger are like, what just happened in this room? You know what that was? That was a commercial for McDonald's from 1975. That's when they had those commercials, 1975. But if you're 40-ish or older, we still remember the words from 1975. Why? Because we heard them so often, right? It's marketing 101. If you hear something enough, it burrows its way into your brain. And here's the problem. If you're told a lie about yourself often enough, chances are you'll start to believe it. Most powerful of all is when you're told a message early and often. I mean, that is a toxic cocktail if it's the wrong message. So in this series, I'm going to get my first tattoo right here on stage. If you keep coming for this series, you're gonna watch. We'll see if I cry. Everybody, you think you'll cry? I'm like, I don't know. I might cry. We'll see. But I've always been hesitant to get a tattoo. And my reason is I know I'm stuck with it forever. Right? Like I'm ADD. I don't even think the same thing 5 minutes later, 1 minute later. And so I'm like, what if I get a tattoo and then decide that's not what I want to have tattooed on me? Like, I don't want to be marked forever in a way that I don't want to be marked forever. But here's the thing. I've been tattooed. You've been tattooed. We've all been tattooed. And I'm not talking about ink on skin. I'm talking about words on psyches. I'm talking about words on souls. I'm talking about the messages that we received about ourselves. And some of us have been marked in ways that we don't want to be marked. Some of us have been lied to. Some of the information that we received was not true. And it's not necessarily that this person who lied to you was this evil monster who wanted to lie and deceive you. Maybe some of us had that. But it's possible it's just a very messed up person who was trying their best but messed you up by lying to you. And they didn't intend to, but they did. Their best wasn't good enough. They lied about you to you, and you believed it. I was tattooed young. I received this message early and often from my father, and the message was, you're stupid. You can't do anything right. You never get, if I ask you to do something, you'll get it wrong every time. You're dumb, you're stupid, you can't do anything right. Those messages tattooed me, like they have defined me and what I thought of me throughout my life. I have spent my entire life trying to prove that I'm intelligent and afraid people realize that I'm not as smart as they think I am. So like in college, I worked my butt off to get straight A's, but I hoped that people wouldn't realize that I had to work hard to get straight A's. Those straight A's got me a full ride academic scholarship to a top 15 law school, and I still didn't feel smart. And ever since, I find that I'll manufacture ways to nonchalantly mention that I got a full ride academic scholarship to a top 15 law school. Why? I'm just trying to prove to you that I'm not stupid. But I'm sure I am. And it's not just stupid. I also feel unlovable, just totally unworthy or incapable of being loved. Of course I do. Like my father was one of only two people in the entire world who was obligated to love me. Like it was his job to love me, and he couldn't do it. He never said the words to me, never showed me love. And so I'm like, if he wouldn't, why would anyone else ever choose to love me? I'll be honest with you, every single time my wife says, I love you, it makes me uncomfortable. Like something inside me flinches when she says those words. And I have spent my life pushing people away from me before they could reject me. Because I knew if they got to know me well enough, they'd find the defect in me that makes me unlovable. So, who tattooed you? Who tattooed you? What message did you receive? Maybe it was, you're only important if you're in the spotlight. Or, you will never amount to much. Or, you're not pretty enough because you're not thin enough. You better watch your weight. Or men will always hurt you. Or you are impossible. Your problem is an identity crisis. You have a false identity, and what you believe about yourself is largely based on what you've been told about yourself. Now, there are other factors that can help to form our identities, and might be true of you as well. Like, for instance, some of us will try to form a false identity. We intentionally form a false identity to prove another false identity wrong. Example, you've got the preacher's kid who everyone views as the goody-goody preacher's kid because it's the preacher's kid. That's not really who she is, but that's how she's viewed. And so she turns herself into this wild child partier, which is also not who she is, but she's trying to prove the false identity that she's the goody-goody false. Or you've got a kid from a trailer park who his whole life tries to establish himself as successful and someone who makes lots of money because he's trying to prove that he's not the poor kid from the trailer park. How do you get your false identity? Another way we do it is sometimes we'll define ourselves by our performance. So maybe when you introduce yourself, you always tell what your job title is. Of course you do. You think you are what you do. Who are you? Look at your resume. That's who you are. Some people might define themselves by their sin. Maybe you did something. Maybe it was bad. Maybe it was big. Or maybe it wasn't that bad and that big. It's just you repeated the same thing a lot of times, and you just can't get past it. And so your sin has become the mirror that you see yourself in. So your problem is that you've been tattooed. You have a false identity. You aren't who you think you are. And the trouble is that you don't think that's what your problem is. But like if I had asked you an hour ago, hey, what's your problem? You might have said, my problem is gossip. I can't help myself if I gossip. Or maybe you would have said, I'm obsessively controlling. Or I always end up with guys who are mean to me. or I eat constantly, I eat more than I should, or I spend money I can't afford, or maybe you think lust, or needing 2 glasses of wine every night to help you calm your nerves, or being overbearing with your kids and you don't want to be. That's what you think your problem is. And because you think that's your problem, you've tried to solve that problem. But the reason you can't seem to solve that problem is because that's not your problem. That's just a symptom of your problem. It'd be kind of like this. Let's say several years ago, you accidentally downloaded a really bad virus on your computer. Ever since, your computer's acting crazy, all kinds of glitches, it's really frustrating, but you don't know about the virus. And so what you've done is you've tried to upgrade your computer. You got like more memory, and you got a new hard drive, and you got a new mouse. You can tell I don't know a whole lot about computers. And you think, I'm getting all these new things for my computer. It's gonna make my computer better. No, it won't, because you're not dealing with the basic problem that you have a virus that is ravaging the basic operating system. And in a very similar way, all the stuff, all the visible things that we see that we're like, that's my problem. No, that's not the problem. And if you try to solve that without dealing with the basic operating system issue, which is what we're calling our identity, well, trying to deal with the problem, maybe it will help a little. Maybe it will help temporarily. But it's not really going to do the trick if it's layered on top of a faulty system. And our system is how we define ourselves. Your problem is that you're not who you think you are. And what you do is determined by what you think of you. But you're not who you think you are. So, how do you solve your problem? Like, how do we solve our problem? Listen, not through self-help. Okay, in this series, I am not going to give you a self-help solution. This series is not going to be Verve's version of I'm okay, you're okay. I've known many of you for years. You're not okay. I'm not okay either. We're in it together. The problem is your false identity, mine too. And the way to solve your problem is to get a new identity, to get your true identity. And the way to do that is not through self-help. It's through Jesus. See, there's really good news, like great news, and it's this. Jesus, turns out, is the ink master. He is the ink master. Jesus is amazing at tattooing people with their true identities. In this series, we're going to learn how he can help us to find our true identity. We're going to see that he did it back then with people he met, like when he walked the earth, and he still does it today. I want to show you just real quick, we don't have a lot of time, but one example from the Bible. If you have a Bible, you can turn to Mark chapter 5. If you don't have a Bible, then it's okay, all the verses are on the screen. If you don't own a Bible, we give them out for free at the Velcro Bar. So in Mark chapter 5, we see Jesus cross a lake. Okay, he crosses a lake, it's actually in a furious storm, and he gets to the other side where there's a town. And in this town, there is a graveyard, like in most towns, and the weird thing, though, is that in this graveyard, there's a guy. He actually lives in the graveyard. That's kind of weird. So let's look at the story starting in verse 3. This man lived in the tombs in the graveyard, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain, for he had often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. Man, what happened to this guy that led to this? We don't know exactly. The Bible talks about him being filled with demons. Now, I don't know much about demons. I don't know how this guy became filled with demons. I do know who he became. He became the nut who lived in the graveyard. The guy who was such a monster that the people in that town had to chain him up in the graveyard for their safety. And I do know that Jesus crossed a lake in a furious storm to seek this guy out. If you read the whole chapter, Jesus crosses the lake, interacts with this guy, and goes back. It's the only reason he came. See, Jesus is always seeking people out who aren't where they need to be. So, Jesus crosses the lake. He approaches the scary guy from the graveyard. The guy actually comes running up to him. Check out verse 9. Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "My name is Legion," he replied, "for we are many." Isn't it interesting that Jesus immediately asked the man for his self-identity, right? First thing he does is he says, "Who are you? Who do you think you are?" And the man says, "You want to know who I am? I am Legion because there are many demons in me." Well, if that's how you identify yourself, that's how you're going to live your life. And what happens next is just amazing. We don't have time to go through the whole story, but Jesus commands the demons to leave, and they do. And in the next scene, the man is completely changed. In fact, all the people from the town come running because they hear that Jesus has arrived, and they see this guy in the graveyard, and they're like, "Who's this? Because he cannot be the nut that we chain up in the graveyard. This can't be him." But he was. He was the same guy. But if you asked him, "What is your name?" he no longer would have said Legion, because Jesus had removed that tattoo and he had given him a new tattoo. He had given him a new identity. Jesus had given him his true identity. And since what you do is determined by what you think of you, it changed his entire life. That's what Jesus wants to do in your life. That's what we're going to ask Jesus to do in our lives through this series. What you do is determined by what you think of you. So we're going to ask Jesus to tattoo us with a new identity, with our true identity. And if we allow him to do that, it will change everything for us in such a good way. But before that can happen, before Jesus can do that, he needs to remove our old tattoos. We need to unlearn some of the things that we've learned about ourselves before we can learn and apply the truth about ourselves. And that's what we're going to talk about. That's what we're going to ask Jesus to do in us next week. Please don't miss next week as we learn how to remove those old lies, to identify that identity we've been living under, and how to get God, allow God to remove that from us. Don't miss next week. What we're going to do right now is just give you a little bit of time for reflection. We like to give you some space just to be on your own, to connect with God, to think about what you heard today and how it applies to your life. So we're going to have the band do one more song. And during this song, I would encourage you to think, to pray, if you pray, and just start to think about, man, is this it? Like, the problems I perceive, are they just symptoms? Have I been trying to change the wrong thing? What are the lies I believe about myself? Am I open to taking a next step and allowing God to show me those lies and to help me define my true identity? And so I hope you'll use this time to do this. And during this time, we also have communion available, which is on the tables around the room. And communion is a piece of bread and a cup of juice that remind us that Jesus came for us, that he came and gave up his life on a cross. The bread and juice represent his body and blood so that he could remove the lies from our life. He could remove the sin from our life and bring us into a relationship with God. So if you'd like to take communion, you can get up during the song and get the bread and juice, bring it back to your seat, and take it when you're ready. By the way, we have a new thing this week. On this table only, we have gluten-free communion. We've had people who that's an issue for, and we are very customer-friendly or whatever. And so gluten-free communion, if you need that, I hope that will be a help to you. So I'm going to pray, and then we'll give you time just to reflect, to think, to apply what you've learned, and to take communion if you'd like to. Let's pray. God, it's such good news when we realize that you love us, that despite us, despite what we've done, despite our fears about our failures, you love us. But there is a very real sense in which that's not really quite enough if you just loved us. But what's really cool is that you love us and you are powerful. And so there are things that we have wrestled with. There are things that we have tried to change. There are things we have tried to start or tried to stop that we have not been able to. And we don't understand why. And we get so frustrated. There are relationships that just are always messy. And we can't relate to people the way we want to. And we don't understand why. And what we learn in the Bible and what sociologists tell us is it's our identity. That's the problem. And that's what needs to be solved. And I don't know that we're able to do that on our own. I don't know. But I do know that you're really good at it. So God, my prayer is, starting today, but throughout this series, that we would really come with open minds and open hearts, and that you would help us to see the lies and the false identity we've been living under, to identify it, to allow you supernaturally to remove it, and to help us to learn and live in our true identities. It's going to be a really cool journey. God, I thank you for the journey that Jesus took across a lake for a crazy man in a graveyard, and he took from heaven to earth for me and for us. And man, thanks that despite us, despite our messiness, you love us and you can change us and make our lives something beautiful.